Welcome to the Oak Shape Podcast Season 6 with your host, Dan the Fitness Man. Thank you for tuning in. We are excited to have you. This is the podcast that is dedicated to hard work, disciplined decisions, and year-round training in the pursuit of the best possible version of ourselves. We leverage elk hunting to create a pathway. We understand that time is finite and we cannot squander a second. We must be leaders at our home. We understand that faith is our number one priority, then family, then fitness, then health, then wealth. Our year-round disciplined decisions help us leave a legacy for our family to follow. You will leave here motivated, inspired, and educated. We bring on a wide variety of guests, subject matter experts, so that you can tune in, get what you need to get, and continue on your journey. We are blessed to call ourselves Elk Hunters, Season 6. Here we go. Hey friends, Elk Shape Podcast got a really nerdy episode today on archery. Sitting down with James Yates, aka Yates in the Backcountry from Instagram. Met him at Western Expo, told him I wanted to get him on, and we talked for quite a while. So this is a little bit longer episode. We're geeking out on archery, getting to know his story, talking about his 230-inch mule deer he arrowed 2 years ago. He's the editor for Western Hunter on the archery side of things. He's an engineer, he's brilliant, and he's humble. He's a father, a husband. This guy's awesome. You're going to love this episode. Without further ado, James Yates, and you're listening to the Elk Shape Podcast.
Yo, can you hear me?
Hey, I got you. Good morning, James.
Hey, Dan, how are you?
I'm great, man. So winter is back in the Northwest. How about you guys?
Yeah, we just got 16 inches of snow overnight.
Are you? Wow. Okay. You guys' snowpack is insane this year, right?
Yeah, I think I've been hearing that the ski resorts are on course to break records. I think they already broke a record through January, and this storm put 16 inches down. I live at the mouth of like Big Cottonwood Canyon, and I think the mountains were supposed to potentially get 3 feet out of this storm.
My gosh, man. I mean, that's good, but you always like you're rooting for the wildlife, you know? Hopefully they're in the range, winter range, and just surviving. Especially these last couple months of winter, man, they're the worst for them.
Oh yeah, it is for sure. The big thing with the weather as it is currently, and the winter range situation here with the, you know, the houses down in the valley and on the benches is, you know, reduction of winter range and all the snow that generally the valley stays quite warm, but man, we've had snowpack at our house pretty much all winter, which means the foothills, with the exception of the direct south facing slopes, are all snowpacked, and they're going to get dumped on even more now.
Man. Well, I'm excited to chat with you today. I feel like we probably have a lot in common, and I think there's some things that you probably are an expert on or maybe a nerd about that I just can't wait to pick your brain. And our audience deserves a proper introduction, and I'm not the guy for that because I don't know you yet, but maybe just give us like a, you know, the 10,000 foot view of James Yates, aka Yates in the Backcountry. That's who I follow on Instagram.
Yeah. I'm a father of two boys, two crazy boys, husband. I'm a chemical engineer, consulting chemical engineer, my day job. I also, the last 2 years, have been doing the archery editorial content for Western Hunter magazine. And just a pretty devout outdoorsman, mostly bow hunting, but I do try to dabble in all forms of hunting to be just well-diversed. But definitely a bow hunting and archery nerd. I started rifle hunting when I was a kid with my dad, and probably 10 or 12 years ago now, I pretty much turned on the archery switch and was pretty much exclusively archery for 6 or 7, maybe 8 years. And then started dabbling back into some rifle hunts and getting a little bit more technical and in long range shooting and applying what I had learned in bow hunting and taking it to the to some rifle and muzzleloader hunts as well. So that's a background on me.
Okay. Love that. So Western Hunter magazine?
Yeah, Western Hunter magazine. Yep.
Okay. Yep. So you are an editor. You do handle the archery related columns. How many issues a year is that?
Western Hunter is 6 issues a year.
Cool. Yeah. I used to do a gig with them for years. I don't remember what my column was, something with fitness or whatever, but writing is a lost art, and it's tough. It's definitely it's kind of a labor of love to pin something that's thoughtful, articulate what you're trying to express, and do it in a way where it doesn't go over everyone's head, because you're super wicked smart. You're an engineer, chemical engineer. So I enjoy your column, and I get the publication to my door. So I'm old school. I just enjoy magazines. I still do.
The good thing about the magazine is you can kind of read it at your own pace. You know, especially I've kind of become known for some really technical archery content. Kind of taking a different approach to things than your common article or blog online. Trying to bring new information, applying my engineering mindset. And there's two good things about the written word. I can take time and write exactly what I want and reread, rewrite. You know, it's not like I'm, you know, sometimes on podcasts or whatnot, which seem to be the craze these days, you can kind of fumble over your words because it's live, but I can make sure in the written word that it's the message is getting clearly, especially on the technical, really technical content, that it's the message is coming through. And then on the reader side, you know, you can reread a sentence or two or a paragraph, you know, 3 or 4 times to make sure you really understand it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm going to pick your brain on archery stuff, man. I'm an archery nerd, except for I'm not an engineer. I just try hard, and I'm obsessed with it. So I want to get into that. But I'm going to rewind, because I know a little about some stuff, and I want to just pick your brain. So the first one I'm going to ask you is about your cover photo on your Instagram page. It is a mule deer that looks like he's easily mid 200s, but I don't know. What is that buck?
So in 2020, I killed a buck on our extended archery unit. He's mid 230s, official gross. He's 228 net. So I guess that's the official score. I hunted him for 4 years, on and off. 2017 was the first year I saw him. He lived in kind of a hellhole and was mostly nocturnal and stayed timbered up. It was quite the adventure. That was right when we started having kids, so I didn't pursue him as heavily that year. 2018, he disappeared on me. I actually didn't see him in 2018. I thought he had died. 2019, I was back in that same area. I've basically been hunting that canyon since 2016. I've killed, I think 4 or 5 of my most recent bucks in that canyon. So I've been in there a long time. And 2019, I looked for him all summer, didn't find him. But I did find a 190 type 3x4, 34 inches wide, that I kind of, after I didn't turn up the really big buck, I decided to go all in on him, and I killed him second day of the bow hunt. So I continued to scout. I placed a lot of trail cameras. That's before the trail camera ban in Utah. And one of those cameras ended up turning up my monster buck at the end of 2019 in the rut, kind of in a migration corridor. The spring of 2020 is when I went up and checked those cameras, and I was with my 4-year-old son at the time. I put him on my shoulders, and we'd packed way up in there, and we're checking cameras. And lo and behold, I've got a picture of, I was literally with my son. He hit him in my lap, and we're checking these cards. And lo and behold, that buck is still alive. And my son was 4 years old, and his name is Canyon with a K. And I asked him what he wanted to name the buck, because I always, you know, I always kind of name the bucks that I hunt. He wanted to name him after himself. So he wanted to name him Canyon. And I was like, oh, wow, that's, I don't want to go around saying I want to kill Canyon. But he was the biggest deer I'd ever seen in the canyon. So we ended up, calling King Canyon, and KK for short. I just refer to that deer as KK. But just a really cool experience. I bonded really well with a couple of buddies that we were good friends at the time. But after the experience of chasing that deer together, we, you know, became best friends. And Luke Holding and Ty Glenn and Jaron Danzy were instrumental in helping me get that buck killed. Jaron, I there were like six different nights that I pulled all nighters checking cameras. My buddy Jaron was with me on like half of those. Luke took like the whole month of Thanksgiving off to come, or the whole week of Thanksgiving to come hunt with me and try to get that buck killed. And then Ty took work off that last day of the extended archery season, and we got him killed that day. So
you literally got him on the very last day.
I got him. Yeah. So the other thing that was kind of stressful is we figured the buck was at least 8 years old. And we'd had a couple of mild winters leading up to that. And we figured that if we had a bad winter, that he could have easily died that next winter. And I killed him. So it's like 108-day extended archery season. And I killed him on the very last day in the last like 20 minutes of legal shooting light. And I mean, it was,
wow.
It was just like the epitome of push it to the end. I drew on that buck six times throughout the month of November, just never had a clear shot. So I had plenty of close opportunities, thanks to my friends and our hard work. I ended up hunting, I think I went 47 times. I live right next to the range, so I'm able to go up and morning hunt before work. So I was up and down the mountain 47 times that year for the deer.
Dude, that is a serious commitment, and that is a grind, and that is 100% delayed gratification. There's nothing that you can duplicate. Obviously, I don't have to tell you this, but for folks listening, like, give us the background on what it's like to get up super early after being up the night before to get the hunt in, get back, get dressed, go to work, do a good job, be a great husband and father, and not, well, you're going to be obsessed with this deer, and it's just going to take you to another level. Like, give us the, I love this kind of stuff.
So I can't remember exactly what issue, but 2021, I wrote a really in-depth, like 6-page article on the entire story in Western Hunter. But yeah, I mean, there were oftentimes if I were scouting, I had 30 different camera locations, but they actually didn't even help me. I got him on camera, oh, I don't know, 10 different times, but there was only one camera location that I got him repeated times. Does that make sense? So he just never held a pattern. I ended up pulling all the cameras down about mid-season because it was just exhausting. And I even at the time, Salt, Buck Jam, I tried it all, and just none of it would. All of that was legal back then in Utah, and nothing would attract him. Typically early on, bucks can be, you know, really attracted to the salt and the mineral. He'd hit it occasionally, but he'd never go back to it. So that was all scouting season. By the time August came around, I think I only got him on camera once or twice after that. And it was always just passing through. Which is pretty typical for us. The deer kind of hit mineral back when we could run it through about early August, and then they kind of just don't want to bother with it. So I would run cameras at night. I'm a night owl. If I had to say my one superpower in life, it would be an ability to function physically and mentally on little sleep. And I got that from my mom. She's the same way. So I'd run cameras at night. There was like six times I pulled an all-nighter. a couple of times I glassed the night before, check cameras all night. And in the morning I would glass. So literally no sleep. And then go into work. That I did pull that like three times. And then, yeah, go to work. But I mean, that's not something that I would do for every deer. This was, you know, we thought any likely was 250 inches in velvet. I've heard, you know, different rules of thumb, seven to 10% difference between, you know, velvet and hard horned. He was like 9 by 11, so 20 points. Imagine if you know, a quarter inch or an eighth of an inch on every point, you know, that's multiple inches just there. And then the mass measurements. But then come the hunt. I'd hunt in the morning, wake up, especially towards the November when the road, when everything was snow packed, took forever to get in there. I was waking up at 3:30 in the morning, getting in there. And then we'd hunt all day. I hunted most every day in November. It was so deep that on that particular hunt, I was taking the days off. So I took the whole week of Thanksgiving off, and I pretty much hunted at least every other day the rest of November and the weekends. So, but earlier in the season when it wasn't as hard to get in there, I'd hunt till about, depending on the day and what I had going with work, I'd wake up at, you know, 3:30, 4 o'clock, run up, hunt the morning. If I didn't see him, I'd get down. And then I'd do kind of a quick little rinse off in the creek, and then change my clothes and head into work. If I was meeting with clients that day, I'd try to run home and get a good shower in or whatever. But and then you know, get home, have dinner with the family, play with the kids, bathe them, get them to bed, nine, spend some time with my wife, work a little bit in the evening to kind of make up for my absence in the morning, and get to bed. I like to say 11, but that hardly ever happens. Midnight, 1 o'clock. I couldn't do that. You know, I can't, you know, functioning on 3-4 hours of sleep, I could probably do that back to back days. But if you're starting to push 3 or 4 days like that, you know, I couldn't do that. But, you know, try to get 3 or 4 morning hunts in a week like that, with a, you know, a rest day in between, if you will.
Definitely, man. So this deer is pretty rando. He's definitely nocturnal. He's mature. He's doing mature buck things. That extended season runs through the rut. You're hoping that he's gonna, at this point, at this stage, let's just talk about the last week. Is the rut over on the last week? Is he pulled off and like by himself? Obviously you're seeing him, so I'm assuming the rut must be swinging, and he's just, you know, hound dogging it all around wherever. Like, how are you guys relocating him?
So fortunately all of the leaves are off the quakies that time of year, so we could peer into the quakey bowls, and the rut's still in full swing. It's not like Montana or Idaho or even Wyoming, where I think the focus is early to mid November. I think here it's personally, I prefer mid to late November. So he's still very much in the rut. The problem with the rut is, and a deer like that, he was commanding a herd of like at times 20 does. I doubt he ever had less than 10 does when he was like really, really rutting. And then he would go in and steal does from other bucks, like other good bucks. So there were two different occasions where the same 170 type 4 point that KK had stolen his does would come in and bomb the does to try to break up the harem so that they could, you know, steal a couple of does. That actually happened twice when I was in position on the deer, and it completely blew up. That happened Sunday. So the last day of the hunt was November 30th. that happened Sunday, the 29th, in a Quakey Bowl. And it happened the very next day, Monday, the last day of the hunt, about an hour before, the last light of, before the hunt closed. I was within, like, I was literally waiting for a shot opportunity the last day, like within 60 yards of the deer, when this other deer for the second time came in and blew up the herd. So all the deer disappeared down into the timber. And I had started working my way back towards our glassing point across the canyon. And my buddy Ty glassed him up, and then we made a plan, and I went back over there, kind of booked it as fast as I could. I was probably only a half a mile or three quarters of a mile, but in the bottom there was 4 feet of snow and there was crusty. So it was occasionally I would break through the crust and lose my momentum. Anyway, got back over there to the south facing side and was able to kind of creep below in the timber because the thermals were coming down. And I really, this hunt kind of demonstrates why I geek out on archery. I shoot a really fast arrow. I have a series in Western Hunter magazine that talks about bow hunting forgiveness. And to me, the ultimate forgiveness in a setup, especially for a modern compound bow, is a really fast arrow that has a really low trajectory. The reason why I call that forgiving is I think personally, in all of my experience hunting kind of OTC general archery deer hunts, the number one error from hunters is misranging. Ranging errors. And the faster your arrow is going, the more forgiveness you get in that ranging error. So I've got this little test that I talk about in one of my articles. I call it my range forgiveness test. So at 80 yards, I want to know exactly at 80 yards how far off I can be on my range estimation and still be within the kill zone on a mature mule deer, which I consider like 10 inches. So I will go and figure out where every one of my arrow setups, how far off I can be on the range and still be in the kill zone. And for my really fast arrow, I can be 3 yards off on my range and still be in the kill zone, which if that's groundbreaking. 3 yards off at 80 is, and honestly, I feel like that's one of the reasons why I killed this deer, because in that last stalk, I drew on him three times, two times where I had to let down. And the third time I drew on him, I actually drew on him and he was dogging does, started walking again. And I actually held my draw. And I just figured that I was, the way that he was working, we were kind of working parallel with each other. And I was staying in the dark canopy below. And when he finally stopped that fourth time, I was already drawn because I was holding my draw and took a few steps with him. And I figured if I was, even just a yard or two off on the estimate, then I'd still be on the kill zone. And I aimed mid body cavity and ended up hitting like 3 or 4 inches low, ended up being a perfect heart shot, and he dropped dead instantly. Shot was just about 80 yards, but it was a pretty steep incline. I think it was hold for like 68 or 69 yards.
Okay. Some good stuff in there. I don't want listeners to miss out on some of this information that I just heard you speak of. So number one, can you quantify, can you give me numbers? Tell me what a fast arrow is. Tell me what a slow arrow is for you. We can only talk about you. We're not talking about you guys listening. We're talking about James Yates.
Yeah. So for me, so right now I'm shooting a Hoyt RX-7. Pretty similar with the Hoyt RX-5. Hoyt kind of radically redid their bows a couple of years ago. Their cams are extremely efficient. Right now, my bow is shooting.
So with the Elk Shape Podcast audience, we want to let you know about all our partner discount codes or calls to action. Save you some loot, get you some good gear. Kufaru, we finally have a discount code. Elkshape 15. Any purchase except for shelters. I run the Hoodlum. Jake runs the Hoodlum. Get yourself the Duplex Light Frame or the Tactical. I have both. I would say the Tactical is a little bit better for colder weather, whereas the Skeletonized Duplex Light works a little bit better in early season like August and September. Discount code Elkshape 15. With the Vortex Optics discount code, you have to go to eurooptic.com. Enter the discount code Elk10. It'll save 10% off any Vortex glass. We also have a Vortex Wear discount code. 20% off all Vortex Wear for your scouting, date night, or workout gear. Enter the discount code Elkshape and it'll get you 20% off. Onyx Elite membership. Enter the discount code Elkshape. It'll take 20% off. You will get the Elite membership, all 50 states, plus access to the digital publication from Hunting Fool. You'll also get a Hunt Reminder membership included, as well as Top Rut and other perks. Onyx has been in the game the longest. Take advantage. Next is Numa Outdoors. That's the hunting clothing we wear in the backcountry. Enter the discount code Elkshape20 to save 20% off. MagView, this is the digiscoping solution made easy. The discount code is Elkshape. It'll take 10% off. Get the A1 and the B1, definitely for your spotter and your bino. It pairs nicely, and it's just a little magnet strip on the back of your phone. You don't have to have a silly phone case. Wilderness Athlete, new discount code for 2023. It is Elkshape23. That'll knock 20% off. Look for the Elkshape stack or the September stack, and ladies, the Mrs. Elkshape stack as well. Black Ovis is where I get my gear. The discount code is Elkshape. It'll take 10% off. Fast and free shipping and the best customer service. Black Rifle Coffee Company, whether you want to become a member and have the subscription to where coffee is delivered to your door in the cadence that you prefer, or you want some BRCC swag, coffee mugs, and even RTDs now, enter the discount code Elkshape, save 15% off anything at blackriflecoffee.com. Fatty Meat Sticks, a great, healthy, non-GMO, crappy, salty, no, this is the best tasting meat stick on planet Earth. Discount code ELKHUNTER gets you a little 5 to 10% off depending on what you buy. Check out Fatty Meat Sticks. Sheep Feet, orthotics for your feet. Discount code Elkshape, take 10% off your sheep feet. I have two pairs. I always have a pair in my boots and my workout shoes. I have high arches. That really helps. At first, I was a naysayer. Now I'm a believer. Sheep Feet works really well for me. Could work really well for you. Put it in your boot. The Elk Collective, the number one digital elk hunting resource. You want to get going on elk hunting, you can practice and learn from others. So instead of listening to one person preach about how to elk hunt, it's an army of subject matter experts teaching their ways of hunting elk. Discount code Elkshape Podcast, all one word, will get you a discount to theelkcollective.com.
I think it's 318 or 320 feet per second, 28 inch draw length, at least on the mods on the bow. My true draw length is a touch over 28 and a half, but I shoot. So the true draw length is never what the module says. They're always, every bow manufacturer is a little bit, long. So it's stated at 28, but it's actually closer to 28 and a half. And then I shoot max let off and I twist up my cables just a little bit to hit like just a touch over 28 and a half. So I shoot 81 pounds, 81 pounds, 28 inch draw length, according to the cam. And 425 grain arrow is going 318 to 320 feet per second. These modern compound bows, especially the new Hoyt Matthews, they are very efficient at shooting these arrows very quickly with minimal noise and efficiency problems. Now that can't be said for bows of even 5 years ago. I think, you know, its specs don't seem like they've changed a whole lot, but I think what has happened is the efficiency of the bow, the quietness of the bow, that stuff has all changed. Like my bow, my Hoyt now, this new Hoyt is shooting a 318 feet per second, 425 grain arrow. It's quieter than, you know, Hoyts or primes of even 5 years ago shooting 280 feet per second. So, and I know that you shoot Matthews, and I know that Matthews have come a long way in that regard too, just being very efficient with shooting light arrows, or lighter. I don't consider 425 grains ultra light. There's guys that are down below 400 grains. But
yeah, I can give you an example of Mark Hayes, lead engineer at Matthews. Shoots a 395 total arrow weight, And basically he said on this podcast, like, look, man, with these newer bows, he literally said what you're saying. The heavier you go with these brand new bows in the last couple of years, you're not gaining any additional efficiency. And so that really like drives a lot of people nuts that want to shoot a heavier arrow. I've come down since 2006. I used to be a full metal jacket dude. And, you know, 505 was about the average weight with 100 grain fixed broadhead. Now, this year, I'm looking at 421 total arrow weight with 125 grain fixed broadhead up front. So these bows are more efficient. You're getting the energy. You're leaking less energy. I am sold on forgiveness by your definition, James. 100%, because stuff happens fast. You get to full draw. An animal takes a step, three steps, and I'm not a built-in rangefinder, and I can't use a sight that has an automatic rangefinder on it in most states out west. So I'm literally sold on your definition, man. I hope people are listening. When did this discovery click for you where you're like, this is truly what forgiveness is for me?
I don't know, 2018, probably, maybe 17. So people just have to get my nature. I've probably not been in the sport, you know, especially I've hunted my whole life, but archery hunting, there's a guy who's guys with a lot more experience than me, but my nature and just my chemical engineering mindset is I just jump into things. And I mean, to the detriment of sometimes I just get a one track mind. And, I mean, within my first 2 years of picking up a bow, I already felt like I knew more than any local shop. And I just stopped going to shops. I bought a press and I started doing all my own stuff within 2 years of picking up a bow. I'm just voracious at learning. And I just feel like with my attention to detail, I'll take the time to set it up how I want to set it up. And if I were to try to pay somebody to set up my bow the way I set it up, it'd be $1,000. I mean, it takes me a month to set up my bow exactly how I want it.
Yeah, no, I can tell. Now 318 feet a second. That's no joke. That trajectory is insane. The forgiveness, I love it. Can you, tell me what arrow vein, like break down your arrow from tip to tail?
Yeah. So I kind of want to also state that, the other facet of this is I also like a really, really heavy arrow depending on the circumstance.
Sure.
So for out west, mostly I'm heavily deer focused, but I do love elk hunting. If I were hunting out of a tree stand, or if I was hunting, over water for elk, or hunting really thick timber and like in the Pacific Northwest, I would shoot a 650 plus grain arrow. For me on those shortest shots, the most important thing is shot angle forgiveness. So if I'm shooting, so I've done a little bit of sitting water and I've killed a few elk and deer that way. What I have learned in that situation and all of that is you don't want to wait for an ideal shot angle. If you're shooting a really fast arrow and a big mechanical broadhead, you know, you got to wait for a quartering away or a broadside shot. In my experience, a 650 plus grain arrow with a really stout fixed blade, two blade cut on contact, like an iron will, I can blow through the meaty part of the scapula. So quartering two shots, frontal shots, I feel a whole lot more confident on those shots with a really heavy arrow. So shot angle forgiveness is the most important thing on your close quarter shots. So depending on the hunt, and another thing that I talk about is I'm able to just with different things, and I walk through this in a really in-depth manner in a three article series from Western Hunter. I can actually get my lightweight arrow and my heavyweight arrow to tune almost identically, so I can shoot both of them at the same time. And often I'll carry a 650 plus grain arrow in my quiver and a 425 grain arrow. And I've got, you know, different bow sights that I've been able to figure out how to track essentially two different arrow trajectories on those two different bows on those two different arrow trajectories on the same bow sight.
Yeah, no, I got to agree with you a little bit here on having that when in doubt, go heavy. For example, like I told you, I was at 505, which is heavy for me. That was 12 years of hunting North Idaho, where I could get anywhere from a 5 to 15 yard shot on elk. And the shot angle is kind of like you get what the good Lord gives you.
Or you don't get a shot.
You don't get a shot. Now, for me, I'm more open country elk hunting now. And so I'm not sitting like water holes or tree stands. You know, I'm on the ground. These are shots are going to be further than 40 yards. Obviously, I want to get as close as possible. But that's why I've gravitated towards that setup. But if I were to come back to my roots and hunt even my own state, Washington, or go back over to North Idaho, I certainly wouldn't flinch at going heavier and even getting into the 600s like you're talking about with like a two-blade cut-on contact or a single bevel, something just where the shot angle, you know, it's not an issue, including calling in elk in those kind of scenarios. Solo where, man, I hate to say it, but you may be presented that frontal and that is a shot you might not want to take with a 400 grain arrow or something like that. But that's cool that you mentioned that, man, really honestly. And there's a lot of whitetail hunters. My whitetail setup definitely is not the same as my elk setup and tree stand hunting, water hole hunting. And I cannot believe the tip you just gave away. Friends, if you are ambush hunting, you cannot be that picky on the shot selection. And so if that's the reality, you ought to consider what James is talking about, is having a different setup. And I love that you have them tuned to come out the same bow. How did you do that?
Yeah. So the biggest thing is just spending a lot of time. I've got, you know, a full shop in my garage. I play around on Archer's Advantage a lot, selecting the spine length. I've been a big believer in, I like micro diameter arrows, give me every advantage I can. And, I'm a big believer in Iron Will insert system. In fact, when I first found out about 6 months before Bill was releasing those collars, he told me, and I was all giddy and excited about getting a collar on the front of a 4 mil arrow. So basically what I'll do is I'll figure out on Archer's Advantage how much weight I need to load up the front of the arrow with to weaken the spine. And then Archer's Advantage gets you close. And then what I'll do is I'll keep an arrow long and I'll cut it back a half inch at a time off the back end. And I'll bare shaft, I'll shoot bare shafts through paper until the one arrow comes in line with the other. You can play with like on a ham ski, you can play with plunger tension, that helps. Knock tuning helps, bringing the arrows into to tune to basically rip bullet holes at the same rest position. Now, the other important thing to keep in mind, there's a lot of people that have wanted to dabble in this since I've had a couple other podcasts on this topic, and I talk about it in the articles, but with a mechanical broadhead. So typically, I should state this. My 318 grain arrow, I'm only shooting a mechanical, 318 foot per second arrow, I'm only shooting a mechanical broadhead on it. That's too fast for any forgiveness from a fixed blade, but I'm only shooting fixed blades on my really heavy setup. Now, mostly just because of the country that I hunt, I've killed more animals with my lighter setup than my heavy setup, but I've killed plenty. I've killed two bulls, three bulls with the heavy setup and a buck. The deer, that arrow just blows through deer like you can't imagine. Blows through elk too. So the most important thing is that your fixed blade broadhead arrow, so my heavy arrow, is tuned perfectly. That arrow, if you're shooting fixed blade broadheads and you want them to get the same point of impact, you need that bow needs to be tuned perfectly, and you need to have a lot of fletching to correct any sort of, you know, any sort of error in your grip. You know, shooting broadheads on the range is one thing, but as soon as you, you know, get on the mountain, I can shoot broadheads as good as anybody. But I'm also very aware of limitations as a human being and the excitement of shooting on the mountain with some breeze, bad footing, or whatever. You know, a fixed blade can, unless you have a lot of fletching, can kind of steer itself up front. So that arrow needs to be tuned very well. And then you can get away with a little bit of, you can get away with a little bit of misalignment on a mechanical arrow, especially if you have a reasonable amount of fletching on the back. In my experience, like with a Sever, I use a Flex Fletch 360 Extreme Vanes. It's a moderate height vein, 3.6 inches long, pretty stiff. That vein in a three fletch will correct a fixed or a mechanical or a fill tip really quickly. So if you're shooting the two arrows, you want to make sure that your heavy fixed blade arrow is perfectly tuned, and then you're bringing in the mechanical as close as you can. Now, for the most part, I can get the left and right play out of it almost fully, just because of the different, I don't know exactly what it is, but sometimes my light arrow, if my heavy arrow is perfectly tuned, my light arrow is going to come in a little knock high, which I've had no problem with it. So it doesn't, the both arrows don't need to be perfectly tuned. I mean, for most people, the level of tune that I get it to, most people would say it's perfectly tuned. I know it's not quite all there, but it's damn close enough for a mechanical.
Yeah, no, I feel you. Now the knock tuning, are you simply just, when you say that, I don't want people to miss that step. So that's generally my idea of knock tuning would still be with a bear shaft and then just rotating the knock 120 degrees until you get it to stay whole.
Yeah. Or to tear a bolt. So I shoot so many arrows in my garage. So I blank bell a tremendous amount. I blank bell through paper just to make sure my form's good. I'd say if I shoot 8,000 reps a year, I shoot a tremendous amount. I'd probably say 5,000 of those are in my garage, just literally at 5 feet, and just form consistency. I'm not aiming. I'm trying to keep my mind keen, trying to break the connection between aiming. And so blank belling is really good to break the connection in your mind between, so your mind, if you constantly are aiming, your mind is going to kind of build this phobia up that if you're on target, your bow is going to go off. And that's when you start getting flinchy. So blank bailing, where you're physically not aiming. I mean, literally when I first started blank bailing, I don't know how many years ago, I would blank bail with my eyes closed. So my mind there. So I break the connection in my mind that being on target means the bow is going to go off. Cause I shoot more reps not aiming than I do aiming, if that makes sense.
Yeah, aiming, man. It's like driving. You don't stare at a white and yellow line when you're driving the whole time. Aiming can be automatic, autonomic. You don't have to, you can stare down there and gaze off. Aiming's going to happen on its own. That pin's going to come back to the middle, even though it's moving. Joel Turner's done a great job at my camps, just helping people to exit the aiming room and get to the execution room. And I do like the eyes open blank bailing. I do.
So yeah. So the other thing that's really, so yeah. So the bear shafts. So I spend a tremendous amount of time, you know, knock tuning, making sure my criteria for a fixed blade going in my quiver is that at 80 yards, I want to be able to hit a 3-inch sticker, like two or three times. And so I'll knock tune until an arrow, and I shoot iron wills, and they're great at holding their edge. I've shot an iron will into a you know, like a Sever target, you know, upwards of 30 times, and it's still shaving sharp. So I put the broadhead on the arrow. I kind of mate those two together. I'll nocturne until it's consistently hitting a 3-inch circle at 80 yards, a 3-inch sticker. And that's how it goes in my quiver. So I've done a lot of playing around with arrows. I have experienced that Easton arrows, I have to nocturne far less. And I think it's probably the Easton kind of has their own process of making arrows called pultrusion. It's a little different process than the wrap and roll process. And it leads to incredible circumferential spine consistency. So as you go around the circumference of the shaft, that spine is very consistent. I've measured it with a RAM spine tester.
I was going to say, do you have a RAM?
You have a RAM at home?
I do.
Yeah, so do I. Now, side question, because I gotcha, bend your ear. What's like the RAM tester do for you? Like, what's like its primary objective for you?
The primary objective is to help me get a good grip on the spine alignment. So I have a good starting point on where to position my knock. So especially when I was, shooting more of a wrap and roll arrow, that was really important to get me in the ballpark, because I was spending a lot of time, knock tuning to that degree, shooting a fixed blade broadhead at 80 yards in a 3-inch circle. That's pretty tight. That's a pretty stringent task. And so I was knock tuning a lot. So the RAM spine tester just helps. Also, I'll put it on the spine tester and I'll watch the gauge and I'll slowly rotate the shaft until I find that the high point, low point, however you want to do it. And then I'll align the knocks so that they're the same. Now that gets me close. It's not perfect. And then the other thing, even beyond that, because knock tuning with broadhead is my end all be all. But it clued me in onto how different arrows perform in terms of the circumferential spine. And it kind of helped me clue in on, so right now I'm currently shooting Easton Pro Comps. It's the exact same arrow technology as the Easton X10, which has won like every Olympic gold medal since like 1992. And the Pro Comp is built the exact same way. And it's a 4 mil arrow you're able to insert with a deep six hit insert.
That's bougie, bro. That ain't no cheap arrow. That's legit right there, man.
Yeah. It's an expensive arrow, but the time that, so to give you an idea, kind of like a wrap and roll arrow, I was having to knock tune, I would say, I don't know, 10 out of 12, 9 out of 12 arrows in a dozen, like an Easton pultrusion, like the Axis or the Axis long range, I was having to knock tune like 4 or 5 out of a dozen. The Pro Comps, I don't have to knock tune.
Okay, that's legit. Now, also, fun fact, the guys who make the RAM spine tester, 30 minutes from my house, man. How cool is that?
Oh, really? So that's rad. They're great to work with. I'm going to be doing, a couple of reviews on how I use the RAM spine tester. And then also their new vice is incredible. I've got one. I've been playing around with it for like 5 months, and I'm going to be doing, kind of an in-depth review of that vice. I love it in this year in Western Hunter magazine.
Oh, I look forward to seeing that. That'd be great. I need another tutorial on how to use this RAM tester, man. Like, I've used it a little bit to find the highs and lows, and I struggle with a lot of them are Victory Rip TKOs, elites, so 0.001, and they're very consistent for the most part, but they come with this mark on there called spine alignment, and I've been trying to debunk it. And sometimes I can, there's always a couple arrows that, hey, this spine alignment does not match up. But overall, Most of them do, which is good to know, but I still find myself doing that last little bit of knock tuning with, you know, my fixed broadheads before I put them in my quiver right before elk season. And 80 yards is also that magical distance for me to really decipher. While we're talking about tuning, I got to ask this real quick, and then we'll come back to your pro comps. A lot of bow manufacturers, and I used to shoot for Hoyt, but it's been a minute. But like Matthews, 13 16th off the riser, you get that rest locked in. Really, you don't mess with it, man. Like if you have a knock right, knock left tear or whatever, you're going to do some wheeling, some orientation, some top hats. I'm sure with a Hoyt, it's similar, or twisting Y yokes or something. But my point of all this is I don't like touching my rest very often. And the only teeny tiny adjustment I might ever do is I might bump it up just slightly or get myself a sight tape dedicated to that fixed broadhead. Are you moving, manipulating your rest at all?
Yeah, I do. But like you, I like to make major movements. And that's actually, I really, really like the direction that Hoyt is going now, because they went away from the yokes. The Hoyt's new cam system is a cross-loading binary cam system that the cable comes out of one side of the cam, goes through the roller guard, and then goes to the other side of the bottom cam, and then vice versa. So they balance really well. It eliminates 90% of cam lean. But the beautiful thing about that is both cables are identical. So the Hoyt has like the most stupid, simple string system out there. It's two identical cables and a string, and they don't come out of tune because they're everything, you know, they stretch at the same rate. It's an exact mirror top to bottom. So they hold their tune. And I also, versus like a yoke and a bus cable, those are different and kind of led to a more spongy back wall. And my experience with the yokes, because the cables are under different amount of tension, they creep or stretch a little bit differently or settle a little bit differently. And over time you kind of lose tune. So that's one thing that I really like about the new Hoyts, similar to Matthews. The shims, instead of the top hats with the Hoyts, I do my bulk movement on those. I actually, 13/16 is what I would consider the minimum on the inside. I prefer to tune personally at like 7/8. And with the shims and the top hats, you can do that. The reason why I like to do that is I'm a big believer in, from a bow hunting perspective. So it's different than target. I'm a big believer in a big peep. I shoot a 7/32 peep for hunting.
Same here. Yep.
I love a big peep, and so I need a big guard so that they line up concentrically. And in order for that big guard not to be kind of eclipsed by the riser, I like to tune a little bit more to the outside. And with these more modern bows with the ability to shim cams or, you know, the top hat system, you can kind of tune a little bit more to the outside. And I found a sweet spot on, I don't know. I've tuned a lot of these new age Hoyts for friends and whatnot, in my garage, and 7/8 seems to be a sweet spot. So,
okay. I got what you're saying. And I think
my takeaways for folks listening is, if you're a little bit like, what are these guys talking about? You need to become more of a student of archery, because go to James's Instagram page and look at his 80 yard groups that he posts weekly. Arrows are touching. I mean, dude, you can shoot. And in order to shoot that well, long distance, you got to have obviously repeatable technique. I didn't say flawless. I just said repeatable. And that's important. That's very important. But the other thing is, like, all that time you're spending in your shop shooting, you know, through paper and at close distances, you are becoming so one with your grip on a bow, which is probably where most people end up losing that long range consistency, is their torque. Would you agree?
Yeah, 100%. The two points of contact are the most important, anchoring and grip. And I'd say, like you said, the grip is more important because it's, you kind of have a leverage effect. You know, you've got the a little bit off on your grip will kind of torque the bow in relation to the knock of the arrow more because of that lever arm. So yeah, just being one with your grip, figuring out what the bow, what your bow likes. And then you can have the shittiest, not the shittiest, you can have really bad form. But if you're ultra consistent, you're going to outshoot somebody with exceptional form that isn't the most consistent, if that makes sense.
I love it. There's a soundbite for you. So break down these pro comps, carbon to carbon. How short are you cutting them? You're putting a hidden insert or using iron wheels, or what are you using? What's on the back? What's your broadhead of choice? And this could be your deer arrow for all I care. I'm impressed with your pro comps, and I'm just going to save up and have to buy me a dozen or two to tinker with, but break it down for us, man.
Yeah. So the pro comp, my deer arrow is a 300 spine, finished weight is about 425 grains. That tunes out well for me. I'm a big believer on minimizing surface area. So I cut my arrow as short as possible. My arrow is my broadhead is over the shelf. From a compound bow perspective, there's really no such thing as being overspined. You just have to have enough spine. So my arrow probably comes in is, you know, if I were to throw in my statistics or my stats or information into Archer's Advantage, you'd come back probably marginally stiff. That arrow, I have, you know, velocity at the same time without getting too light. So you should never really drop below five grains per, like, I'm trying to remember my rule of thumb. I it's been so long since I've tinkered with that arrow. I've shot a 420-ish grain arrow for so long. I think a good rule of thumb is like a minimum of 5 grains per pound of draw weight. I'll have to fact check myself on that one, but so that pro comp, so I shoot Flex Fletch 360 extreme vanes. It's from what I've found, it is a very, I like a really stiff vane and I like a really light vane. So it's just got this great combination of being very stiff and very light. It's a medium profile vane. So, you know, I'm a big believer in limb driven rests, but the one downside of limb driven rests is you can get some bounce back on them as the bottom limb oscillates, right? That makes sense. As your bottom limb is oscillating, your rest can come up. So, I know that, you know, the higher profile vane and you're starting to get contact issues with like a limb driven rest, it's most likely that rest bouncing back up a little bit. So I like that it's a you know, medium profile vane height wise. So I never have contact issues up front. I shoot a 25 grain iron will, deep six hit insert and, a 25 grain iron will collar. And on that arrow, I shoot a 1.5 inch sever, 100 grain deep six.
That's what I was looking for. Now, any wrap on the back, and how much does each vane weigh?
No wrap on the back. I try to minimize weight on the back of the arrow. If I want to add weight, I'll add it up front in the insert.
You hearing that, kids? Did you hear that, kiddos? That's why I don't wear a wrap either. Yeah, well said. Put the weight up front. Now, sorry to interrupt you. What was you saying on the vanes, weight per vane?
That vane, I think it's like 6.6 or 7 grains per. So pretty light for how stiff it is. I mean, you look at it and it's a very thin material, but it's super stiff. It's really quiet. It's my favorite vane. With fixed blade broadheads, I would like it maybe if it was a little bit taller. That's the big thing, that surface area isn't one-to-one on a vane. Especially if you're shooting fixed blades. So this is going to really geek out, but I do a high order I do a high order modeling for my job called computational fluid dynamics.
Okay.
It's basically representing it's basically representing physical phenomenon, and it's virtually represented with the, you know, actual physics in a computer simulation. And so I do a lot of fluid flow modeling. So one thing that's kind of important that I've actually chatted with Bill quite a bit about, is especially with fixed blade broadheads, no amount of surface area close to the arrow shaft is really going to outperform height on a vane. And the reason for that is as the velocity profile develops, starting from the arrow shaft and propagates outward, the actual velocity profile as the arrow is moving through the air, so the air velocity right near the shaft is actually not high. It's called a boundary condition. So it happens in fluid flow. Think about the foil, the foil on a sports car. That foil is lifted off the back of the car quite a ways. And the reason for that is there's more friction and there's more air movement coming up off the car to help drive the front of the car down. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So the same thing goes with a vane. Right next to the arrow shaft, the velocity or the pressure exerted on the vane is not very high. Nothing's going to, just because it's kind of a stagnant zone of the air as the arrow is moving. And as you propagate out from that arrow shaft, that boundary layer builds and the velocity is going much faster. The air velocity is going much faster as you propagate out from that arrow shaft. Well, faster air means more pressure on the tips of your vanes. So that's where I'm saying that the height of the vane, nothing, especially if you're shooting fixed blades, nothing's gonna outperform a taller vane. The problem with taller vanes is you can have some contact issues. They're a little bit more noisy. So that's where I was kind of making the point that with my mechanical broadheads, that medium profile vane works really well because it just doesn't need to steer that much. But if you're having issues with those medium height profile vanes with fixed blades, it's because of what I just explained to you. They need to be a little taller to get into a spot in the fluid dynamics that vane is seeing more pressure. And that pressure and force is what allows the arrow to correct itself. So it's just like a parachute. The vanes on the back of an arrow are like a parachute. So they literally provide resistance so that the back of the arrow wants to track immediately behind the front of the arrow aerodynamically, because that's the path of least resistance.
Well said. And I love that. I've discovered like last year I ran AEE Max Hunters.
The Max Hunter is really tall.
Very tall. And I'm going away from them this year because they definitely steer the best, obviously, but they are considerably loud and everyone knows that. So I am currently tinkering with several different ones, but the AEE Hybrid HPs, they kind of look like a Blazer knockoff. They're ribbed. That's what I'm on to right now. Those are steering broadheads very well. They're not as tall or as loud, but yet they're still tall enough to steer very well. They are helical, like I'm using the Arizona Minimax. So I got an insane helical on those. But I've done in the past, I like the Max Stealths, pretty big AEE fan. My buddy who runs the gear side of things on our channel, he's running the Super Sabers. And so far we haven't tested with broadheads yet, but he's really into it.
Yeah. Another vane to look into, if you like that parabolic shape from the kind of the Blazer, the Easton Bully vane. It's actually made by Blazer.
Oh yeah.
Or by
Bully. Oh yeah. Yep.
It's, I actually like it more than the Blazer, and I'm actually going to play around with that vane on my fixed blades this year. The Bully vane came out like a year or two ago. It's actually a blazer profile made by Boning, but it's using the Boning heat vane material. So it's ultra stiff. I'm just a big fan of ultra stiff from a noise perspective. Now, ultra stiff can, if you do have contact issues, obviously the stiffer the vane, the more it's going to throw your arrow if you have contact issues. So barring contact issues, which I think you can get away from, I really like a stiff vane.
And you're a three vane dude, correct?
Yeah, I just with the rotation of the arrow, I feel like a fourth vane doesn't add like a third more steering. It adds a third more weight vane wise, but it doesn't add a third more steering because you're getting because of the rotational the rotation of the arrow. So I just find that it's just more efficient trying to minimize the weight of the arrow on the back, the weight of the back of the arrow.
Well said. Yeah. I mean, I'm in the business of selling elk-shaped vanes, but I am not going to put four vanes on the back of my arrow. Like you just said, I'm not seeing a third more correction steering. And I like to put the weight where it matters. So, all right. I know we're going over an hour. I did not realize you were this cool. I'm joking. I knew this would be awesome. So I got to hit a couple more things real quick, because I'm sure you're on a time crunch.
I'm actually okay for a bit still. So okay. As long as you, I've probably got another half hour.
That's about all I got too. So I want to squeeze the juice. All right, let's go back to the buck real quick. I want to hear your response to this statement, because this is true. I did watch a video on YouTube from a YouTuber, is what I'm gonna call them, those darn YouTubers. And it's about your buck, but he doesn't say, I don't think he says your name or whatever in the video, but it's like he was after that buck as well or something. And it's his version of the story. It looked like there was some drama. I don't really want to get into drama, but like maybe your response to that whole scenario for those that didn't see that or understand that there was some competition for this deer.
Yeah. And I won't deny it. That individual hunter, I don't have any major beef with. There definitely was some competition. Everybody's got their side of the story. My side plays out a little bit differently on my perspective on how things went down. I'm not going to throw him under the bus or anything. I think we both really wanted to kill the deer. That individual hunter had a lot of time on that buck as well. And I'll say that he had more time on that buck early, you know, in those years of 2017, 18, 19. But I do fully believe that last year that nobody outworked me on that deer. It is what it is. When I killed the deer, he came, it was kind of a somber moment for him, but you know, we kind of rejoiced together. So props to him. You know, I consider him a good dude. I gave him some of the meat from the deer, let him make replicas. And I hear that, I actually haven't watched the video. I've heard about it plenty. It is what it is. It's the Wasatch Front. I don't mind saying that. If you want to come hunt here, be prepared for Mortal Kombat type hunting. This is not the first time something like this has happened. Anybody with a valid archery tag in the state can come hunt the extended. And I'm not kidding you. Any given, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, there could be 5,000 to 10,000 hunters in a relatively small area. I just don't take the front for something that it isn't, right? It's not my 16-mile deep Colorado hunt or my 8-mile deep archery elk hunt in Idaho, right? I just got to know that I'm going to be dealing with shit from other hunters. There's going to be some competition. I play it a little differently. You know, I hunt escape routes. I don't think that the other hunter or myself, I don't think ever once did we intentionally screw up the other guy. No, I can't speak for him, but I never intentionally screwed him up. I don't think he ever intentionally screwed me up. We're both just trying to kill the deer. So,
hey, it's going to happen if you hunt public land and long enough, you're going to bump into other people. You're not always going to meet, your best friend on the mountain. You're not always going to meet somebody stoked to see you either. My advice would be, and this is kind of more of an elk hunting advice, because I've hunted the public land hustle forever, is, man, there's always more animals in other places. Your best bet generally is to just go back to the maps, go to your plan C or your plan Z. You could even have a great conversation on the mountain, but it, you know, you still can't control what they're going to do. They're humans. And there's a lot of, there's some ego involved in hunting to the detriment of all of us. So there's always going to be that. So yeah, man, I think you guys handled it well.
Yeah, I was just going to say in his defense, man, he had a lot of time on that deer, and that guy, like I said, before the last year, he put a tremendous amount of effort, and he did the last year, but the last year, like I was beyond obsessive. So he had a huge connection. And if you're kind of seeing the level of my mind and my detail oriented nature, you'll see that when I obsess over something, I mean, it was just, I just spent a stupid amount of time on that deer. So, I mean, I totally get it. He wanted some meat. He wanted the replicas, because he just had a significant amount of time on that deer, and I'm not going to fault him for that.
Sure.
And I'm just not the type to, you know, a lot of people ask me why I never responded to any of the stuff when that video came out a year or two ago. And that's just not my style. Everyone's going to have, you know, there's egos involved. Everyone's going to have a different opinion. Did I feel like that story played out a little differently? Yeah. But it is what it is. He's a good dude. He works hard. Props to him.
That's great. We'll end that there. And man, not responding is honestly sometimes the hardest route to take. Trust me, I get shade thrown at me on a daily basis. I'm sure you do too. But like I literally posted something this morning that was kind of inspirational. One of my kids, one of my guys that works for me, edited up a really cool inspirational piece. He was stoked about the edit. I'm like, cool, I'll post it. Second comment, you're a self-promoter. And it's not even, and it's just like, you got to like realize some people wake up in the morning and just want to throw shade. Now, every part of me wants to get on my keyboard and type up some stuff or whatever. But the harder, better route is often to just let it slide and live your life. So good for you, man. I respect that. I want to talk about three pieces of gear in the little bit of time we have left. And I picked these out on purpose, man. This is only part of the podcast I'm actually quasi prepared for. Number one, I was today years old when I found out that you helped design the ADAC vinyl harness system, which I ran for a few years. And I thought, this thing's genius. It finally like solves all my problems, but no offense to you. Then I got in love with marsupial and I haven't looked back, but I did run ADAC. That was you, man.
Yeah, that was me and my wife. Yeah. My, 2015, I made that. It took a while to get it out to the market for whatever reason, but yeah, I sewed up a prototype, my wife did, helping me, out of necessity, because I hated every vinyl harness on the market. And that was me. I just didn't have the means to kind of produce it myself, you know, kind of the financial means and the know-how. So I sold the design to good friend Kendall Card, and they took it, and it's kind of died off a little bit with the competition in the vinyl harness market. I do think some are still available. I don't know what the future of it's going to hold, since I'm kind of been out of it since I sold the design. It was great. It saw, you know, I still run that harness, my prototype that I've got made out of a Sitka jacket. It was great. Solves the problems. It's really quiet.
Dude, mad respect. And Kendall Card is my dude. I love that guy. He is a gangster. That is so. I just wanted to like point out how cool you are. That I didn't know you made that, and I bought that, man. I ran that for a couple of years. So mad props. Okay, number two out of three. Do you have your video on? You don't have to. I don't need to see you, but can you see me?
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, great. You've probably been staring at me the whole time, picking my nose. This is the Epix from Garmin.
Yep.
I have the Instinct, and on my left hand, I'm wearing two watches, not because I'm weird, but because I'm testing right now. This is the Polar Grit X Pro from Polar. Love the Instinct. I've never touched the Phoenix. I'm going to try to get one. This Epix weighs, it's like a brick. I'm not kidding. Like, my right arm's going to be buffer than my left just because it's on that wrist. But I wanted to geek out with you real quick on the Garmin lineup watches, since I know you know some things. Instinct, Phoenix, and then this Epix, the Connect app. What, from a hunting standpoint, can you like highlight some of your favorite features of the Garmin watches? And by the way, I'm not sponsored by Garmin. I don't have to say a nice thing about them at all. I do think they make great stuff. With that being said, could you run through like your favorite or best practices with your Garmin?
Yeah. So I run a Garmin Phoenix. I haven't always run a smartwatch. Couple of things, you know, just having the altimeter, I can tune exactly from a hunting perspective. From a training perspective, most of my training is done to maintain a heart rate. I hate wearing a heart rate monitor, so I much prefer it on the wrist, even though it's not as accurate. So I'm constantly looking at the heart rate monitor. It's a convenience thing, but you know, when I'm out, I do a tremendous amount of running, especially this time of year. So it's convenient that I'm out on a run, I don't have to, if I get a text message for work or family or whatever, I don't have to pull the phone out of my pocket. That's more of a convenience thing, but something I've actually really, really enjoyed, being able to read a text message on my wrist. Similarly, I could run without my phone, and I could Bluetooth, music to my headphones if I needed to. The altimeter, like I mentioned, it does have GPS. I've never been in a situation where I've lost or my phone has died, but it does serve as a backup GPS device with mapping. So keep that in mind. I'm a big believer in having backup devices. So I also run a Garmin, InReach. I even though the Mini is great, I prefer, a handheld model. Yeah. The Explorer that actually has mapping. Yeah. Because I've dropped a conventional topo. So I have, if my phone takes a dive on a hunt, and some of my stuff is really committed, like we hunt 16 miles deep in Colorado, or you can kind of get disoriented in, you know, big forests for elk hunting. So I have my phone, and then I've got my InReach Explorer that's GPS with mapping, and then, and, you know, if I'm ever away from my pack or whatever, I've got the Garmin with the GPS mapping as well. The Phoenix. So those are the big issues: the heart rate, the altimeter. I kind of my training perspective, like I said, is mostly heart rate. I do this time of year, I'm running purely from a heart rate. As it starts to get a little bit warmer and the mountains start to thaw a little bit, I'll start to track mileage. So that's really nice to start tracking mileage as I start gearing up for that sort of thing. This year, I'm kind of coming off a knee injury that happened late in December. So I almost took the entire month of January off. So my cardiovascular conditioning is not where it normally is this time of year. So I'm kind of building back up, which is why, especially this year, I'm really focusing on heart rate. Once the spring kind of comes, this year it'll be different, but I do get out and do some shed hunting more from an exercise perspective. Late spring, I like to do, weighted, like really, you know, like 50 pound, really steep. I hike the Mount Olympus Trail here, which is a really steep, punchy in the face climb. I do that for heart rate, but I'm actually really trying to push my heart rate there. I've got a buddy, Ty, who's gone head over heels in body physiology and this sort of thing, and he knows all the technical terms for it. But I'm a big believer, in a hunting perspective, being able to operate, and I don't know the technical term for it, but I've always been able to red line for a long time. And I think that's partly because of some of the intensity training that I do. I can keep going, red line, really fast heart rate. You may know this because you're more of a fitness freak than I am. But being able to push myself with a high heart rate and, you know, producing that lactic acid, I'm still able to push it because that's what I train for.
Okay, that's a whole nother podcast. But Cliff Notes is that's awesome. It sounds like you have probably a bigger VO2 max, which is the volume of oxygen that you can take in and consume. It seems that you've moved your lactate threshold up and up and up to where your body can utilize lactate acid as an actual energy substrate versus it just stirring around in your muscle groups and adding an acidic environment and your enzymes breaking down and you have just chaos, you can actually flush the system faster. And a lot of zone 2, zone 3 training will help with that lactate threshold. That's a whole nother podcast. And then the redlining is going to be like your zone 4, zone 5.
Yeah.
I will say the Polar app does a better job graphing and it has a better chest strap, which you don't like wearing, but Polar is the better brand for the chest strap. Their Flow app, from what I can tell, does a better job showing me what zones I was in and how long. But the Garmin seems to have more features that a hunter would care about, like you mentioned. I'm trying to do a comprehensive review, James, and it's just like, I'm just doing it to help people. I really am struggling because it's just like these things do so much stuff that I don't need them to do, but I'm still trying to learn them. You know how that is, right?
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, the for sure. Yeah, lactate threshold was the term that I was brain farting on. I tried to, especially this time of year, I'm in that 2-3 zone, but I'm really starting to redline and push that lactate threshold come the spring. And that's in direct preparation for the scouting season and hunting.
Yeah, I get into zone 4 really like infrequently, but if I want to do it on purpose, just go run sandhill sprints. And depending on the size of the hill and the amount of rest you don't give yourself, you'll get there. And then a lot of my CrossFit style conditioning pieces will have me at zone 3. Most of my strength training is circuited, so it is zone 2. And I encourage everyone to get a heart rate monitor just to learn more about your body, your heart rate variability, how fast you recover, your resting heart rate, your max, blah, blah, blah. Last question, man, because I'm telling you, we could do a whole podcast about what that fitness stuff, because that's my jam. I love that.
Yeah, that is your jam.
Here we go. Hopefully you can see this.
The baby. I just got one too.
Okay. Yeah. But you already you've used yours. So Dan Evans is a really good friend of mine. I've known him a long time. And I said, Dan, I see you're coming out with a new site. We should come over to your house. I'd like to do a YouTube video on you anyways. Nobody knows who you are. And you're like the best elk hunter I've ever met in my entire life. And, you know, Dan Evans started Trophy Taker. They made my favorite broadhead for years until they sold. And now that stuff's made overseas. It's garbage, but they had the Shuttle T he bought from a guy named Butch in California. I remember when he did that. Love those broadheads. He was making the Smackdown Rest. Love those. He sold that. So now he's doing the option sites. And here is the Canyon Pounder. This is the 5-pin. I'm a little intimidated, James, and I'm usually one that doesn't get intimidated with archery equipment. Can you give me a brief couple of highlight things, because I haven't even put on a bow yet and I'm going to be messing with it and learning all about it. What are some of your favorite parts of the Canyon Pounder?
The first and foremost, beyond just the obvious option part of it, just being able to flip out the fixed pins, that drive, I mean, that's what his product is known for. So that's obvious, right? That's super robust. I won't need to talk about that. That drive system is the best drive I've ever seen on a bow sight ever.
It is smooth.
There is zero. Now people think that bow sights have zero slop. This bow sight truly, that drive truly has zero slop. That drive is the helical. I mean, the part, that helical drive that he has in there, the precision of machining that drive would have required. That it's not easy to machine that. That drive is a feat in engineering. The other thing that I really like is from a hunting perspective, where you're not using a lens, I like how his third axis is adjusted and it's only in the bubble. The reason for that is a lot of other manufacturers have their third axis adjustment that is on the kind of on the dovetail arm, or it's kind of in between where the dovetail connects to the slider drive. And the way, so that area right there is very prone to getting bumped. So I've noticed on a lot of different sites, so I'm not going to just pick on one, that third axis is prone to getting bumped out on other bow sites, particularly the bow sites that have the third axis adjustment in the arm that connects to the bow. There's just a lot of, if you bump your bow sight out in the field, it's going to get bumped in the direction of that third axis. And the bow sight, you know, the slider drive, the scope housing, that's all 3 or 4 inches forward of typically where that third axis adjustment is. So that bumping just acts as a lever arm back to where that fulcrum is, or the pivot point is for the third axis, and it can get bumped out. It's screwed up. It's screwed with me on hunts. So I love the Spot Hog because the third axis adjustment is super robust. This third axis adjustment of Dan's is very robust because it's just in the bubble. It doesn't actually move the scope housing. Now, if you're shooting a lens, that's a problem because you right. do want the scope housing to be centered to your eye or flush to your eye. But from a hunting perspective, that won't matter. The other huge thing, and we already touched on it, is my two arrow setup, depending on what my hunts line up for the year. If I geek out on a two arrow setup, which I'm planning on this year, because I've got a kind of a more timbered elk hunt that I want to do. So I'm going to really geek out on a two arrow setup again this year. The Canyon Pounder is the best non-electric sight on the market for a two arrow setup. There are two places for sight tapes. Right there on the front and on the back. I'm basically going to focus on my heavy arrow being the fixed pins. I got the 5 pin as well. I may ditch one of the pins and go to a 4. My primary slider pin, the 1 pin, will be my light fast arrow, and the fixed pins and that backside sight tape will track my heavy arrow. And there's just not a sight on the market that's going to be able to do that as well. Non-electronic, the Garmin does a great job of it, but for a non-electronic sight, like you were saying, the Garmin isn't legal in every state. That Canyon Pounder is amazing.
Okay. James, you did not disappoint, dude. In fact, I got to meet you in real life. Want to hang out? We would probably do some tinkering and do some shooting and do some working outing and swap some stories. So appreciate you guys. Give him a follow. I'm going to leave a link to his Instagram page and check out him in the Western Hunter magazine. And James, thank you so much for taking time out of your day. Last word is yours. You got anything else you want to say?
No, man. I appreciate, I've known about you for a long time. It was good to shake your hand at the Western Hunt Expo and talk shop a little bit. And it's good to get on with you and respect what you do and trying to help getting people motivated to get in shape and tinker with your bow. I love your content from a tinkering perspective. I think that lets people know that, you know, the more you commit to this sport and of bow hunting and fitness, the better hunter you're going to be. I strive to, you know, teach the same principles in the content I produce. So props to you and trying to motivate people and just being a force for good. I respect the hell out of you for that.
Likewise, man. Appreciate your humility and just the fact that you're so driven. It's contagious. And I want to spread that through the waves of this podcast. So God bless you guys. Remember, separation is in the preparation. We'll catch you on the next one.